The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights reported over 6,000 deaths in Syria's civil war last month, which made it the conflict's deadliest month so far. The hostilities, which have been underway for over 2 years now, have polarized the country and forced neighbors to either flee their homes, support the Free Syrian Army, or support the forces loyal to the country's leader, Bashar al-Assad. PBS's Frontline series sent filmmaker Ali Lambert to cover the story from both sides of the conflict, and his report, Syria Behind the Lines, follows a young charismatic soldier fighting alongside the rebel-led Free Syrian Army and a lieutenant stationed on the regime's front line assigned to keep the rebels from advancing into government-held territory. The documentary airs tonight at 10 on PBS stations. I'm very pleased that it brings filmmaker Ali Lambert to our show today. Hello.
Hi there.
I read that you were the first Western filmmaker to spend extended periods of time with soldiers on both sides of the conflict. But I wonder, how did you get access to the regime's forces?
Well, that's a very good question, and it's not one I really know 100% the answer to. We spent months making all sorts of inquiries and approaching various figures within the regime, from government ministers down to secretaries, journalist fixers, translators, anyone who might have a contact. And we just try to argue the case that, to be blunt about it, journalists are moving in very easily into the northern areas of Syria to see what the rebels are doing. And would it not be in their interests to let the world see what it's like in a frontline village that's home to regime loyalists? And I don't know exactly who gave us the final tick and gave us a green light, but a message came through that we'd be met in Damascus, and I flew immediately to Beirut and then got a taxi and was met after a few days by a couple of regime security officials who escorted me up to a loyalist village, and there let me film for a few days in a frontline base and talk to regime soldiers there. It was more than I ever expected to get, and I hope it gives some kind of insight into the thinking, in the regime.
Well, you have to take a taxi from Lebanon into Syria. Were they aware of the fact that you were going to film on the rebel side as well?
Well, at that point, I already had filmed on the rebel side. I wasn't asked if I had filmed on the rebel side, and it didn't come up in conversation.
You weren't going to offer
that.
Yeah. Did they try to prevent you from filming certain things? In fact, did either side pressure you to, well, the rebels, you hadn't been on the loyalist side yet, but did they, well, and they didn't know that you'd been on the other side. I guess this is a silly question. So how long did you spend with each of the outfits?
It's an interesting question. I mean, whenever you make a documentary, you always presume that people will be reluctant to talk. But in fact, the truth is always that people are desperate to talk once they're being given assurance that they're being listened to. And that goes for anyone, whether they're a very senior politician or a carpet cleaner in South London. People want to talk, and they want to tell their stories, and they want to be heard. So actually, even, filming with regime soldiers or regime officials or villagers or rebel commanders, once you gave an assurance that, look, I'm not here to judge you, but I would like to hear who you are and what have you got to say and what do you believe in and what kind of Syria do you want, people want to answer these questions. So that wasn't really the problem. But to answer your question, I spent 3 weeks on the rebel side and then 2 weeks on the regime side.
The regime? Go ahead.
It would have been nice to spend longer with the regime, but they did eventually get a bit twitchy about us being there, so we were asked politely to get into the car and leave,
The regime soldier that you trailed was Lieutenant Ali Ghazi. What was his day-to-day like?
Well, I've covered a lot of conflicts over the years, and as ever, the reality of any kind of conflict is that most of it is incredibly boring. It was surprising going to the checkpoints there because from the rebel side, the presumption is that the regime is very heavily armed, very disciplined, very organized, you sort of expect to walk into these regime bases to see a lot of dead-eyed, sort of shark-eyed, cold-blooded killers. And actually, the young guys that I met in those bases were incredibly similar to the young men I've met just across on the other side of the front line. the day-to-day life is not pleasant. I mean, they live in quite basic conditions. They're living in the base that I spent a lot of time in. They were, you know, living sort of 6-8 to a room, mattresses on the floor. They would eat and sleep all in the same place. They would be constantly be on watch across the front line to see if there was any kind of threatened incursion. It was wet. It was dank. You know, it's an unpleasant life on both sides. There's no getting away from it. It's pretty tedious.
And you also followed soldiers, as we said, in the Free Syrian Army, the FSA. How far are they stationed from the regime outpost where you met Lieutenant Ghazi?
I mean, less than a mile. I mean, I could see. I was actually, when I was on the rebel side, I filmed with a farmer whose farmland is now in the kind of no man's land between the two sides.
Can he still farm?
No, it's too dangerous for him to go to his fields regularly. So he go every 2 or 3 days. He'll take this very dangerous journey into no man's land to look at his sugar beet crop. But when I went with him on one of those trips, we were shot at quite heavily from the regime base that I was about to go and visit. A few weeks later, I actually interviewed a regime commander in the exact spot that I'd been fired at from. And I did ask him, you know, do you ever open fire? And he said, yes, we'll open fire if the rebels come. And I said, would you ever shoot at a farmer? And he said, no, we only fire at people who are carrying guns. Unfortunately, I couldn't say to him, well, you actually fired at me a few weeks ago. That would have given it all away. But there's a lot of misinformation floating around. But it was too dangerous just to cross between directly from one village to the other. The only way to travel from one village to the other was to do what I did, really, which was to fly, get out of the country, then go back in via Damascus, and then travel back to the same place.
How did you come to choose Ahmed as the person that you would document with the FSA?
He stood out from the beginning. I mean, he sort of chose me, actually. I mean, I spent a bit of time with this particular rebel group who were the main group in the village that I was staying in. And I did a bit of filming with them, but he was just this sort of cheeky chappy behind the camera. When I tried to interview his commander on the first day, he wanted to sit behind the commander holding up a piece of paper in which he'd written in biro his Skype address. And I just thought this was quite funny because he was just this young, quite childlike, fun guy who was just sort of messing about.
Very good looking, too.
He's a handsome chap, yes, I'm glad you thought that. And he's just like a kind of kid that you'd meet down your own street in many ways. I mean, he looks a bit terrifying when you first meet him. He's holding his Kalashnikov, he's growing his beard, and he likes jihadist songs. And yet when you talk to him, he's got a sort of naivety about him that I found rather sort of charming. And in a way that the revolution and this conflict, fighting the regime, is probably the most exciting thing to have happened to him in the last few years, definitely, if in his lifetime. And that kind of enthusiasm for a new country, or really sometimes just something to do, was something that I could understand. And it's not dissimilar, I'm sure, to a lot of young soldiers, be they American or British or Syrian.
You filmed some scenes inside his home, and it appears to be nicely furnished. So how would you characterize his family's social status?
I suppose you'd call him a sort of middle class, I guess. He's his dad owns a couple of motorbike repair shops. His mother had been a kind of journalist in the past, though she was a bit vague when I pressed her about her history. And, yeah, he lives in a good house. He's got a television in his room. He's got a room to himself, which is quite unusual. I think he's kind of a good, average, rural Syrian kid. And I think the story that I filmed with him, I mean, I filmed him over a period of weeks. And in that time, he did seem to make a transition from a very sort of pleasant, charming young man into someone who's really quite radicalized. By the end of the film, he's quite badly injured in a government airstrike, and he's talking about his desire for martyrdom, as is his mother. And that was, I really wasn't expecting to see that kind of transition.
Although there's a lot of talk about martyrdom in the film.
There is, but it's important to separate out when it feels to be hyperbole and when it's actually heartfelt. At the beginning of the film, one of the first times I met him, Ahmed was talking about how he wants to be a martyr, and he almost sort of gave me a wink. It's almost as if that's the way that you speak. It's like American soldiers saying "hooah," you know. It's like that's almost what you say. You say, you speak in an Islamic way. By the end, I did feel that this had kind of taken root in him somehow. But the issue of martyrdom is very interesting because, yeah, these rebels are often talking about the desire for martyrdom. But that is almost exactly the same as what was being said to me amongst regime soldiers. One regime soldier said to me, "Look, we're all martyrs in the making." And that's that. It's only relatively recently that Syrians are talking in this way, talking about martyrdom rather than death. Another regime loyalist said, "You either win or you die." And there's I think the familiarity with so much death has been going. It's been going on so long now, this conflict, that death is kind of a currency which people are able to employ. And both sides see themselves in a situation where they either fight dying or they win.
You said that go ahead.
No, I just said it's a bit of a bleak outlook, but that did seem to be an interesting parallel.
You say that the setting of your film, the Orontes River Valley, serves as a metaphor for Syria's overall armed conflict. Mm. Those who support the FSA are on one side of the river, and those who support the regime are on the other. Now, what would account for their allegiances in this area? Were they once friendly neighbors?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is one of the extraordinary things about this location, and it's why it was going to provide such an interesting focus for a documentary that might explain something about the situation in Syria. It's a beautiful rural valley. It was a tourist spot until the revolution, and it's a beautiful, lush rural valley with the Orontes River stretching down the middle of it, and that river, until recently, would irrigate all the crops in this very fertile plain. And the communities on both sides, you have the Alawites on one side and Sunnis on the other, they would help each other in each other's fields, they would work together, they would visit each other's houses, they would go to school together. There was even intermarrying between these communities. And sadly, what's happened now is the river has become a dividing line. And it is the center of no man's land, and to cross the river means going into the other side's territory. You now have only Alawites on one side and really only Sunnis on the other. So it's a very sort of stark image for the way that Syria may go. Syria is not entirely breaking up in this way. This is a microcosm of what might happen. It's not that in many other areas of Syria, there is some kind of coexistence. There is communication between the two sides. Unfortunately, that is going to become harder and harder the longer the conflict continues, and that can be seen most kind of in a most focused way in the Orontes River Valley.
Well, fighting came rather late to this area. The civil war was a year old when it broke out here. What changed?
Well, that's a very interesting point. The Syrians are it's easy to forget when we watch the news because we presume that everyone's sort of very violent and involved in a civil war in Syria. Syria is a very kind of developed, a very cultured society, very well educated, prides itself on its education. And even talking in a sectarian way, defining oneself in terms of one's religious or ethnic makeup, is almost a taboo in Syria until recently. And it was almost like uncouth to ask someone what religion they were or what ethnicity they were. What's happened now is that in this area, amongst the coexisting communities, they did manage to hang on to some kind of equilibrium for just over a year in the valley. But what was happening as this sort of end of the first year approached was Sunni villages began having demonstrations against the regime every Friday, public demonstrations calling for the fall of Assad. And they would march to like a village hall. Now, that village hall is shared by the next door village, which is an Alawite village. And the Alawites were obviously watching these demonstrations with growing unease. And it became very tense between the two villages. Eventually, it was almost inevitable in a sense, fighting broke out between these two sides, the Alawites began a counter demonstration in support of the regime, which became heated. Shots were fired, people were killed, then houses were burned, and suddenly you have localized ethnic cleansing, where the Sunnis fled to the other side of the valley, and the army arrived to enforce order.
I want to follow up on that in just a moment, but we have to take a little break.
Sure.
Ali Lambert is my guest. He filmed on both sides of the lines. In fact, his film is called Syria Behind the Lines. It premieres tonight at 10 on PBS stations, and we'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Ali Lambert, who, what did you do on this film? You wrote, produced, directed, edited?
No, I did, it was me with a camera, and I did all the filming, and I had a local person who would act as my translator and sort of local producer on both sides. Then I bring the material back and I edit it with an editor called Christopher Swain, who's a good colleague of mine. It's not everything, but with the Frontline team, of course, who are it's my first film for Frontline, and they're the big boys really when it comes to international documentaries. So it's a real privilege to be working with them.
And the film Syria Behind the Lines is premiering tonight at 10 p.m. on PBS stations. You have described this as largely an Alawite-Sunni conflict. So let's talk a bit about Alawites. Where do they stand in the Islamic spectrum?
That's a very good question, and I'm really sorry, don't feel qualified to fully answer that. There's something of an enigma to my mind. Every Alawite that I met, if I interviewed them, I would always ask them, what is an Alawite? You know, what is it that you believe in? And it was, in a way, became less and less clear to me the more I asked that question. It's certainly the case that the Alawites are an offshoot of Shia Islam. But who they actually worship is not entirely clear. The Alawites have it's quite secretive. The people who fully understand and have read the books, as it were, are a minority, and it's like a guarded secret religion. But they don't worship in any organized way that I saw. So it really, it's become almost the Alawites now in Syrian society, from what I saw, seems to just represent being a loyalist of the regime or someone who is aligned with the regime. Certainly, Assad has convinced the majority of Alawites that their fate is aligned with his, and that if he goes, they go. And that is one way he can bolster support for his own regime. But who the Alawites actually are, I think, I'm sure there are theses written about that, but they're not ones that I've read, I'm afraid.
Well, in Iraq, we had Saddam Hussein, who was a member of the Sunni minority, ruling the majority Shiite population. That caused a lot of tension. Even more dramatic is the situation in Syria, where the Alawites command so much power over the Syrian political system, despite the fact that they only comprise about 12% of the population.
Less than 12. There hasn't really been a proper census in Syria for many years, and so there aren't very good up-to-date statistics about what the percentage of Alawites is in the country. It's genuinely regarded, I mean, I've heard it's about 10 or a bit less percent are Alawites, but you have a 70% Sunni majority. Although Alawites, when you speak to them, will always say, well, there are Sunnis and there are Christians within the regime, which is true, but it's also true that it's usually an Alawite who will hold the most senior position. The deputy is often Sunni, but the commander, as it were, is very often Alawite. And I think that, you know, in the film, I did interview an elderly farmer, a Sunni farmer, who'd lived in the valley all his life. He's in sort of mid-late 60s. And he used a very interesting phrase. He said that the revolution, when it started, he said it sort of woke us up to a sense of injustice. And I think that's a very useful phrase, because I think it made many Sunnis, majority Sunnis, realized that there has been an inequality in the country, and that was one of the big motivators for the revolution at the beginning.
Well, where do the Shia and the Christians fit in? Are they allied with the Alawites because they fear a Sunni majority rule?
I mean, it's hard to generalize, but as a general rule of thumb, the Shias are largely in support of the regime, yes, and the Shias and the Alawites are almost seen as one and the same by many rebel fighters. As far as the Christians go, and there are many other minorities, there are Kurds, there are Mershids, there are Ismailis, as Syrians will say, we're a country of many colors. That was the code they used. The Christians occupy a very precarious position because I had to drive through a number of Christian towns on the regime side. And although they are on the regime side, it's fairly well known that they're sort of trying to sit on the fence, not because they can't decide, but they're in a very precarious position. There's also all sorts of stories about the smaller sects. I know there was a village near us of a minority sect that was actually on the Alawite side, but they were supplying weapons secretly to Sunni fighters because they were in Alawite territory, but they wanted to bring down the regime, but they couldn't come out against the regime or they'd be punished. So the minorities are really in a very precarious situation in Syria and having to play a very clever and careful game as to how they can stay afloat, as it were.
The faction Ahmed fights with is called the Martyrs of Syria. Can you tell us about the group and about the man who commands it, Jamal Maarouf, who claims to have 10,000 fighters under his command?
Yeah, I mean, it's very, very local. The rebel fighters are very localized, not entirely, but in the area that I was in, there's a group of about 30 or 40 villages that are controlled almost exclusively by the Martyrs of Syria. And the leader is a guy called Jamal Maarouf. He's a local guy. He used to be a sort of painter and decorator. He's a sort of working-class guy. He's very much a man of the people. He's a devout Sunni Muslim. He has three wives. And he's just one of those people who has floated to the surface because he has got a way about him that people just respect. He commands the young fighters' respect, and they will fight for him, and they believe in him. You can drive for a few miles, and you'll suddenly be outside of the command of the Martyrs of Syria, and you'll be another group called Sukur al-Sham, and they're run by someone else, and you'll go a few more villages, and you're in someone else's territory. What I found very interesting, particularly when I came out of Syria, was to read about how everyone in the West is talking about foreign fighters and Islamic terrorists and al-Qaeda. In the time that I was on the rebel side, I didn't meet a single foreign fighter. I didn't really meet anyone who didn't come from that village or the villages around it. The battalion, the rebel battalion that I was filming with, are almost exclusively local guys who've come back to their home village and they've joined the local branch, as it were, and that would mean coming under the command of Jamal Maarouf.
Although there are foreign fighters. Yesterday, a federal court judge ruled against a man named Eric Haroun. He's an American and a former U.S. Army private who, the judge said, had actively and knowingly participated in fighting with a group the U.S. has designated as a terrorist organization, the Nusra Front.
Yeah.
Mr. Haroun claims that he joined up with the Free Syria Army, a group that the United States supports, and after a firefight against government forces, he ended up with a group from the Nusra Front. So it can be a bit confusing at times who the person next to you is.
Important to keep that in perspective. I mean, there are foreign fighters. I mean, there was a piece in a British newspaper, The Independent, last week. It began by talking about the waves of foreign fighters that are sweeping Syria from Britain. And it's only in the fourth paragraph that you read that actually the current estimates are that about 100 people have gone from Britain. Now, although
that's a small wave.
It's a significant number, but put in the context of tens of thousands of armed rebels against the regime and a very, very well-equipped regime army, it's a very, very small number. And while I can understand our interest in them, it's not true to say that it is awash with foreign fighters. It certainly wasn't the case in the place that I was. There wasn't a single one. So I just think it's important to keep it in perspective. And that talking about this, the wave of foreign fighters, is being used by both sides in the conflict to either encourage or deter a certain course of action that they want the international community to to take. So I think it's often worth keeping it in perspective of a very large nation, a very large mobilized force on both sides, exactly how much power and how many of them there actually are.
Many say that the rebels' advances are due to improved weapons and training. Where are they coming from?
Well, I think you could probably write a doctoral thesis on the flow of arms in and around Syria. The most interesting revelation recently has been the appearance of Croatian rocket launchers that have come in seemingly via Jordan into the south of the country. And there are various theories about how these could have got there and whether they could have been involved, whether the United Nations or NATO could have been involved in that. I haven't seen anything conclusive about that. The majority of weapons that I saw being used were actually ones that had been stolen from the regime when rebels had managed to overthrow a regime base. The guys I was with actually had a tank that they'd nicked off the regime and had found someone who could drive it, and I saw them quite happily rolling it into battle. So weapons are around. Wherever there is any kind of conflict, you'll find arms dealers, and you'll find a way to get those weapons in and out. It would be fascinating to be able to chart a single Kalashnikov around the world, because a lot of them were starting in Russia, gone via Afghanistan, Iraq, who knows, Libya, and now they're in Syria, and who knows where they'll be in a few years' time. But I think they're coming from all sorts of areas. You know, everyone talks about the lack of foreign intervention in Syria. There is actually a great deal of foreign intervention in Syria at the moment. You know, Russia is heavily involved. There's training going on in Iran. There are Iranian troops inside Syria. Saudi Arabia, Qatar are also involved. So it's never quite as simple as it seems. There is a lot of, there's a lot of guys around. There's a lot of people wanting to make money. There's a lot of people trying to sort of push their agenda. But I'm sure that you could chart the influx of weapons from many different nations in Syria at the moment.
According to the Union of Syrian Journalists, at least 153 journalists and media activists, citizen journalists, have been killed since the conflict began. And your film includes a number of scenes where you were shot at or put in close proximity to extreme danger. Were there times when you feared for your life while you were making this film?
Yeah, I mean, I sort of fear for my own life most days, really. And
there was a bomb that dropped only 300 yards from the meeting place where you were filming.
Yeah, I mean, there were a number of... I had sort of four quite serious close calls, all of which were closer than I'd ever really wanted to be. They always came without warning. I was shot at. I had mortars land within about 40 metres of where I was filming. There was the airstrikes. I had mortars come in to land probably about 30 or 40 metres from my house on the last night that I was there, while I was in bed. So, I've covered a lot of war zones, and there is nothing like this to compare. It was unprecedented in my experience, the levels of violence and bloodshed. I was trying to sort of explain it to myself in a journal, and found myself writing that I had just never seen so much death. It's a very, very extreme environment out there.
In fact, it's estimated, at least as of February, that 70,000 people had died, but that's February. Who knows how much? And the statistics seem to be rather cloudy. Just one more thing. The Alawites were persecuted in Syria. Do you think that the reason that Assad has held on so long and has continued to have support is that there is a memory of that time when they were persecuted, and now the feeling is if they don't hold out that that's going to happen again?
I mean, that's a good question. I do think that the sort of memory of persecution does run quite deep within Alawite communities. There's a phrase that's used that's something like, the idea of Alawites returning to the hills. Historically, they were very poor, occupied very poor land, and were, second-rate citizens in many ways, historically. And they're now, they've gone to the top of the pile, as it were, and do hold the reins of power. I do wonder if that is a driving force. I think it's a very good point. I mean, like I was saying earlier, when people are feeling that their backs are against the wall and they might face some kind of annihilation or persecution, it will make them fight all the stronger. And it does give you some idea of the mentality that might be driving them now, certainly. I mean, there's the idea of persecution and annihilation is just is present on both sides, I think, but it might be more of a resonant debate amongst the Alawites, yeah.
And since it's still unclear how this thing is going to play out, it's also unclear as what impact it's going to have on Syria's neighbors, Lebanon especially, since Syria's played such an important role in Lebanon. We don't have any time left, but I was wondering whether you spoke to anybody in Lebanon about that.
No, I didn't. I mean, I do sort of read the papers, and one of the most dangerous things about this conflict is the spillover. Lebanon in particular, but it's also having an effect in Jordan and Turkey, and that can only sort of spread further afield. But
Syria Behind the Lines is premiering tonight at 10 p.m. on PBS stations. Thank you so much, Ali Lambert, for talking with us today.
Good to talk to you. Thanks very much.